about strokes. Strokes are a major problem. Much more major a problem than heart disease or heart attacks. Not that there are more strokes than there are heart attacks. There are more heart attacks than there are strokes. But people either die or get well of heart attacks. But often they are disabled and don't get well of strokes. That makes them a much more major problem. Because if the person stays in the home with a stroke, then that person is a burden to themselves in their home, and it can be a very serious problem. And so the monetary value of a heart attack as compared to a stroke is usually very heavily weighted in favor of the strokes. They cost much more. It costs much more to have a stroke than it does to have a heart attack. Now, I'm showing you here a general diagram of the nervous system. Now, you'll notice as you look at the nervous system that it is very complex. And this is a very simple, very, very simple, simplified, let me put it that way, version of the nervous system. Someone has said that the most complex thing made on this planet is the human brain. We are a specimen of our Creator. We're made in His image, we're made in His likeness, and we are a specimen of God. What a privilege it is for us to have this kind of bearing, that we would bear the likeness of our divine Creator. Let us be sure that we do bear this likeness. We are not as attractive as our divine Creator, but we can have His character. And so here we see a little bit of the nervous system of a human being. And we will not go over any part of it, just to show you how complicated it is with the brain and all of this meshwork of nerves that have so many interrelationships for us. It is an amazing thing for us to be endowed with such equipment. Now, so that you can know the anatomy of the head, since we'll be talking a good bit about the head and about what happens to the various structures of the brain and the head, I'd like you just to take a look here at this. And here you will see the brain and its blood vessels over the dura. This white part here is the dura. Dura means hard thing. And it is a hard, a very tough membrane. Very tough membrane. If we did not have a skull, we would still be very well protected by the dura, which covers the brain. And then, that isn't all. Even past the dura, we have leptomeninges, too. We generally call it meninges, but there are two layers, leptomeninges. And so these two layers cover the brain itself. Between each one of these, there is a little space, so that if you get something that afflicts one space, you're still protected with the other spaces somewhat. And then there is a space between the meninges and the brain. And so from the scalp down to the brain substance, there are many, many layers. The epidermis, the dermis, then the galea, the periosteum, the outer table of the cranium, and on, the bones and the middle table and the inner table of the cranium are all separate spaces. And then after that comes another space, and then the dura. So you see, we've been well protected. It's obvious when you study even the anatomy here, to say nothing of the physiology and biochemistry of it, that our Creator put a great weight on the human brain, a great premium on it, and protected it very well. If we get an infection in any one of these layers, can't just go rampant and get right down to the brain. We have some protection from it. If you have a hemorrhage, can't go right down to the brain unless it's in a certain layer, unless the hemorrhage occurred in a certain layer. You're protected so that the layers themselves give you some protection. It is a most marvelous thing to study, and I really wish we had a lot of time just to study this part. And let me point out to you the blood vessels here that travel in this area. They come down in this way. They come up from the center. Actually, they go out in this way and then fold back over the dura if it's here, and then go up over the meninges, over the dura. This is the dura, and here over the brain substance, and the spaces that you can see here are those spaces that carry the dura, the leptomeninges. And the blood vessels, as you see here, are very much involved in what we're going to be studying today. Now let us take a look at understanding strokes. You can see here the brain uncovered, and it has almost no covering on it. If it has any covering at all, it is just the meninges, and I don't think it even has that in this diagram. And the blood vessels that you can see coming out here on the, or as you can see projected here on the surface, are actually deep in. And I'd like us to focus on this diagram right here. This is called the circle of Willis. And when the brain is, if you look on the inferior surface of the brain, what you see first is the circle of Willis, a marvel of divine engineering here. Because there are four different ways that the brain can be nourished. We have the two internal carotids that go up here and go into the circle of Willis in the front part. And then we have the two vertebral arteries that feed into the circle of Willis in the rear. So the circle of Willis is furnished by four arteries. Now, these four arteries themselves are connected with each other, so that if one gets plugged up, the other three can furnish the circle of Willis with enough blood to carry on all the functions of the brain. Ideally, or theoretically, if we are young and our blood vessels are all in good shape, if we have only one of these four available, we can supply the blood to the circle of Willis. Now, the circle of Willis has arteries that go out to the brain substance. The first ones that you see right here, these little ones that come off first, this, by the way, is called the basilar artery that leads into the circle of Willis. And coming off the basilar artery are the two cerebellar arteries. Now, the cerebellum is this part right back here. Then we have here the posterior cerebral artery, the middle cerebral artery, and the anterior cerebral right here. they penetrate the substance of the brain. Now, you've just taken about 2 months of anatomy lesson in just these few minutes. I hope you feel very much more enlightened. One thing that I want you for sure to know is that this is a masterpiece of divine engineering. And every time I study it, I am more thrilled with the work that has been done here. And we only skim the surface of what we know is just a very small covering of what is there. There is much more there than we could ever know. Now, with this little bit of anatomy, I'm having a little bit of problem with this overhead because I can't see. Looking here, I can't see what is here. It's almost invisible, so I have to look up here. But let me just talk with you a bit about what we have here. Here we have an intracerebral hemorrhage. Here is the substance of the brain, and here a blood vessel broke and bled into the brain. High blood pressure is one very good reason for that, but also a little aneurysm may also be. Do you see here in the circle of Willis, do you see this little bubble that sets up here on this artery? This little bubble is an aneurysm, and with high blood pressure, they rupture. Then they give a hemorrhage between the brain, not into the brain substance, but between the brain and the skull. And usually that's beneath the dura. So it's called a subarachnoid because it's in this space right in here that this hemorrhage occurs. In fact, here you can see one, a subarachnoid hemorrhage right here. And maybe I can bring that into a little better focus for you. Oh, yes, maybe we could hit the overhead lights and that might help a little bit. Now, just the front one, that's good. We have not only the intracerebral hemorrhage here from something like a small aneurysm, like in these arterioles, see these microaneurysms that are here? These microaneurysms can rupture and give you an intracerebral hemorrhage. But we can also have what is called an arteriovenous malformation. These structures occur in the substance of the brain. More frequently, they are in the cerebellum, this little back part of the brain, which has to do with smooth and coordinated movements. If something happens to your cerebellum, then you make jerky movements and overshoot and cannot make smooth, coordinated movements as you should. If you get a stroke in the motor strip, which is right here, then you may get paralyzed. Let me just bring this down a bit. Let's see which one is that. This one. This is the motor strip right here, and this is the sensory strip just behind the motor or the movement strip. So anywhere in this area that you get a stroke, a hemorrhage, or a blood vessel plugged up, then you will have a problem with movement. If the stroke occurs on the right side, you will have a left-sided paralysis. Now, I don't know if there are any questions so far about this. Let's just talk about another type of stroke, and that's I've talked about the hemorrhagic type. Let's talk about the embolic type. That's where a little ball of blood clot breaks off from somewhere else and travels to the brain. What part of the anatomy would be the most likely to give rise to such a clot? It would have to be the heart. because if it occurs down in the lower extremities or in the trunk somewhere, those clots are going to go where? To the lungs, because it goes into the right side of the heart and is then pumped to the lungs before the blood goes up to the head. So a clot forming inside the heart gives rise to balls of blood clot that go to the brain and cause a stroke. Now here is a diagram of the heart and reasons why the heart gets clots in it. And here you can see a little clot in the atrium. Do you see that? The atrium of the heart can, at times, under certain circumstances, stagnate the blood and cause a clot to form. Those things that can stagnate the blood, atrial fibrillation is one, but also mitral valve stenosis. And here is the mitral valve right here with these very nice corda tendineae here and papillary muscles. Heart is intricately made and it's just a pump. And if there is a stenosis or a tightening of the mitral valve, then that allows the atrium to dilate because it can't get blood into the ventricle easily. So the atrium dilates rather largely and stagnation occurs and a clot can form right there. And then you can see also some little vegetations right here on this valve. This is the aortic valve. The aortic valve can get little tiny abscesses on it, or little bacterial growths that look like a tiny abscess. And these can break off and go to the brain. If they do, then they cause two kinds of problems. They plug up a blood vessel, and then they grow. The bacteria grow, and you've got an abscess in the brain as well. And so that can be really quite serious and very devastating because it destroys the aortic valve and also destroys a part of your brain as well. So very devastating kind of stroke. So anywhere that we get an embolus or a little ball of blood clot plugged up in an artery, we're going to get an infarct on the other side of it. And so we can get a myocardial infarction. We can get a cerebral infarction or a cerebellar infarction or anywhere else, the adrenals or the spleen or the liver. Anywhere a blood vessel is plugged up, we can get an infarct beyond that or a place where there is death of tissue. All right. I know that there is probably much more that you would like to have some understanding about, but let's go to understanding hypertension. If you know that you have someone with hypertension in your family, or diabetes, or cancer, or heart disease, or overweight, if you have any of these in your family, then you are more susceptible to hypertension. These five disorders together make up a syndrome. What's that syndrome called? Syndrome X. Have you heard of that? Syndrome X? It was described about 20 years ago or more, maybe 25 years ago, by some Texas doctors who saw an association in families of these five disorders: diabetes, overweight, heart disease with problem with the blood fats as well, hypertension, and what did I not get? Cancer. Those five things make up syndrome X. So if you have a family history of any one of those, especially in a first degree relative, mother, father, brother, sister, son or daughter, if you have any of these disorders or diseases in a first degree relative, then you're very likely to have any one of the others. If you get a breast cancer, you're very likely to get you're more likely to get colon cancer. To get prostate cancer, more likely to get colon cancer. Or a heart attack. So you see, these diseases tend to be genetically linked. And so if you have someone in your family with hypertension, it might be a good bit of counsel for you to purchase a blood pressure cuff and take your blood pressure from time to time. I recommend this. You can get the equipment, both the cuff as well as the stethoscope that goes with it. You can get that for under $30. Very good kind. Or you can, if you wish, get the very automated types that you just put a finger in, and for $250 it will tell you your blood pressure and your pulse as well. You can even get them for less. But if you want to just have some good equipment that is manual, you can get that for under $30 at usually at a drugstore or some other outlet for this kind of equipment. Now, with hypertension, the big problem is with the arterioles. We have the heart, then the aorta, then big arteries, medium-sized arteries and small arteries, and then past the arteries, we have some more muscular blood vessels called arterioles. The arterioles cause hypertension. They do this because they are very numerous, and they are much more likely to give you high blood pressure than the big ones, because there's such an enormous bed of the arterioles, the tiniest arteries that we have. And the muscle of the arteriole is about, the diameter of it is about, the lumen is about one quarter the diameter of the entire vessel. What's the rest of it made of? Muscle. And muscles are susceptible to a number of problems. High level of thyroid, the muscle is tight. Little emotional tension, the muscle gets tight. If your minerals are imbalanced, that muscle gets tight. Certain types of drugs will make the muscle tighten up. And so as the muscle tightens, it makes the lumen even smaller. And so that gives you less space to carry your blood in. And so, because you have the same amount of blood, but a smaller space to carry it, puts pressure on it. And so the pressure backs up into the arterial tree, and behind that, in the venous tree. So both the veins and the arteries have more pressure on them, and this causes us to have high blood pressure. Now we have systolic and diastolic pressures, and here the company that made these diagrams thought that 120 over 80 was a good level for us to say this is blood pressure. And that's fine with me. We call that the upper limit of ideal blood pressure. So if your blood pressure is below 120 over 80, we call that ideal. Now what if it got to be 40 over 10? Well, I might raise my eyebrows at 40 over 10, but what about, let's go to 80 over 40. What would you think about that? It's not bad. Yeah, it's not bad. I'm glad some of you agreed with me on that one. It's not bad. Now let me tell you what is, in fact it may be excellent. Let me tell you what makes you feel faint with low blood pressure. It is when the pulse pressure is low. What is pulse pressure? Pulse pressure is the difference between the systolic and the diastolic. And so here, 120 over 80 What's the pulse pressure? 40. So if you have a rock that falls 40 feet on top of Mount Everest, it's going to fall with a thud, isn't it? If you're down at sea level and you drop a rock 40 feet, is the thud going to be the same? Exactly the same. Yeah, it'll still fall 40 feet. Do you get the point? Circulation is dependent on the difference between those two. The difference between the squeeze of the heart and the relaxation on the veins. So what you want is a good pulse pressure, not so much a good blood pressure. Or it's for circulation, the pulse pressure is more to be looked at than the blood pressure. So far as your arteries are concerned, the pressure on them is what we're interested in. And the lower the pressure, the better. For every 10 points that your blood pressure goes up, you increase your risk of getting a stroke by 15 to 20%. Every 10 points. So between 120 and 130, now at 120, there aren't many strokes. At 130, there aren't many strokes. But if you're at 130 rather than 120, you have 15 to 20% greater likelihood of getting a stroke at 130 than you do at 120. Not many either way, but it's still that much more. Now, when it gets to be 170 as compared to 160, it's more significant, do you see? There'll be a lot more. Every 10 points, your risk of getting a stroke increases 15 to 20%. So we want to be aimed at is a low blood pressure. The lower the better. And we consider 120 over 80 to be the upper limit of ideal. And we want to aim at an ideal blood pressure. Now, if we have high blood pressure, then the arteries are a problem. They are under more tension, and you're more likely to get hardening of the arteries. And that's the third major cause of strokes. One is hemorrhage, a second is an embolus, and the third is closing up of the blood vessels due to hardening of the arteries. So with hypertension, you're more likely to get hardening of the arteries. More likely to get a thick left ventricle because the heart is pumping harder against greater pressure. It simply develops a bigger muscle, just as any muscle will get bigger with use. The heart muscle gets bigger with use, and as it gets thicker and thicker, it diminishes in its ability to serve you. So just right is what we want on the thickness of the left ventricle. Also, the kidneys have a problem. The eyes have a problem. The brain has a problem. And many other organs have a problem when we have high blood pressure. So let's take the books that you have had distributed to you, and let's turn to the first page, and we'll study a few things about strokes. And we can have the lights on if someone will just flip the light switch there. And there are some of you who do not have books. Let me announce again, for those of you who came in late, these books belong to New Lifestyle Books, and they will, if you want to keep them, we want you to have one during the lecture so that you can follow along. But if you want to keep them, then you'll need to pay $3. You can do that either by paying cash now, or you can send an IOU with Andrea to New Lifestyle Books and go by there and pay anytime at your leisure. Now let's start on page 3 of the book, the definition of a stroke. And I've already gone over that with you, the hemorrhage, an embolism, or a thrombosis. Now let me just mention a little bit about a hemorrhage. Okay, we'll take that one back. Check and make sure that you have a page 3. Andrea, we need another one here in replacement of this one. Now, as one of the ones who wrote this, I would like it if on this preliminary edition, if you find any typos or any sentences that don't sound good to you, I'd like you to let me know before my son makes a more permanent edition of this. All right, the definition of stroke is the sudden onset of a deficit in your nervous system caused by a hemorrhage, an embolism, or a thrombosis. Now let's look at the immediate complications of a stroke. The first thing is something may happen to the blood pressure. It may rise, it may drop. That's a complication. If it drops and you've got a thrombosis or an embolus, that's not very good, because the blood pressure needs to stay up in these instances in order to pump blood past the place where the embolus is or where the thrombosis occurred from the hardening of the arteries. And so a little head of pressure is better for the brain in these instances. If you have a hemorrhagic stroke, then you want the blood pressure to go down. And if it stays high, you need to take some measures to bring it down. Strokes caused by hemorrhage are often associated with a severe headache. And they may tell you, this is the worst headache I've ever had. One of the professors at Emory in the Department of Pathology was lecturing one day, and that was where I studied pathology, and he was the chairman of the department, and he suddenly said, "Oh, I just ruptured a berry aneurysm." Aneurysm? That little bubble that I showed you there? He was correct. Within 5 minutes, he was in a coma, and he died that afternoon of his affliction. Everybody thought he was a very smart doctor to make his own fatal diagnosis. And in a sort of a macabre way, I guess we could say that he was. He was a very brilliant young man and died young. I guess he was in his 40s when he died. All right, the second complication, the last paragraph on... Oh, by the way, not everybody with a berry aneurysm dies. My brother had the same thing, sudden onset of an extremely difficult to bear headache. So he told his wife that something terrible in his head. It was more than just an ordinary headache, but it was 11 o'clock at night. So they were in bed, and he decided to wait until the next morning. But his headache got so bad that he couldn't. So his wife called the doctor, and he made a correct diagnosis and said, "In this small town, we cannot handle your husband's problem. You need to take him to Atlanta." And so he was taken to Atlanta from South Georgia by ambulance. I don't know how he survived the trip, but when he got to Emory, they operated on his head immediately. As soon as he got there, they operated on him and evacuated the big clot that had accumulated in his subarachnoid space, a space between the dura and the brain, and clamped off or clipped off. We use something that's just like staples in paper. Staple it off and sort of it sticks up like that, and you just put the staple on it like this, and just leave the, don't bother even to sew it, just it's left, and surgeon gets out as quickly as he can because the patient is almost never in really good condition. And he survived well and has never had any more trouble with it. And that was probably 15 or 20 years ago. So not everybody with a berry aneurysm dies from it, but they can be serious enough, and if the blood pressure is high enough, they can die of that very quickly. And these blood vessel malformations that I showed you there, they can also leak, or they can have a major rupture, and the person can die from that too, or they can have multiple ones of those and eventually die of one if it isn't corrected. They are almost 100% fatal if they aren't corrected, but you don't have to do it immediately. I have 15 minutes more, do I? Brother? Oh. They won't let me go very long.
That's the treatment for hemorrhage. For the treatment for a clot, they do a cauterization now, don't they? And that's the exact right.
With a. There's several things that should be done, and I will go over these for you here. Okay. Now, I mentioned the fact that something can happen to the blood pressure, and the second complication is swelling of the brain. Swelling of the brain occurs because anytime there is any injury to tissue, its response is to swell. So the brain does that too. And then the next thing is on page 4, the first paragraph beginning on page 4, the extension of the clot is another complication, and therefore for an embolus or for a thrombosis, anticoagulation of the blood becomes very important. Now, if you were way away from any kind of hospital or medical treatment, could you accomplish anticoagulation? And the answer is yes. There are several things that you can do. You do not have to have the powerful anticoagulants that are used in hospitals. You can accomplish this part. If this were all that it were necessary to do, you could do this at your home if you were willing to do it. But I advise you that if you have professional help available for a stroke, that you avail yourself of the best that you can get. Now, if the patient can swallow, you can give a teaspoon of chiolic liquid garlic every hour for 8 hours, and then every 2 hours for 3 or 4 times, and then four times daily for several days. Now, at the same time, you can mix up some turmeric. Turmeric has curcumin in it. Curcumin, coagulation properties. And so a half teaspoon or a teaspoon stirred into a little water can be given to the person to drink. If it's mulberry season, you can give them mulberries, and that has an anticoagulant in it. So do purple grapes. They contain resveratrol. Grape juice and peanuts and mulberries all contain this very nice anticoagulant. Now, some immediate results of strokes are given there on page 4. And some long-term results from strokes on page 5. And then a description of the disability involved based on the area. And then let us take a look at the causes of strokes, because causes of strokes also have to do with treatment. So, fevers and infections in people who have some kind of inflammatory disease, such as arthritis, lupus, or any of those kinds of inflammatory diseases, the collagen diseases, that can set the stage for a stroke. So, infection around the gums, or a chronic abscess of some kind, or a chronic active ulcer on the skin or elsewhere. Now, notice in italics the name of Chlamydia pneumoniae. Do you see that? It's in the paragraph that on top of the page 6, paragraph that ends there. And right at the end of that paragraph is Chlamydia pneumoniae. Do you see that? That is the name you will more often see this just written, chlamydia. Chlamydia can cause high blood pressure and therefore can cause strokes. And there's an article in the most recent edition of Medical Tribune telling about the research that is now being done on chlamydia and trying to link it with strokes. Acute stress, that's the first paragraph beginning on page 6, can be a cause of increasing the likelihood that you will clot your blood inside your blood vessels. Consequently, if you're under an extreme stress, it might be well if you took some garlic. Or if you do public work and you don't want to be around people smelling garlicky, then you could take grape juice. Or you might take some turmeric. Just, these are foods that will not harm you, and you can take it during your time of extreme stress. And the one of those that appeals to me the most is the grape juice. Doesn't that appeal to you? I like that treatment. I don't mind garlic either, but it is a little difficult working around other people. Now, notice aggression. This is in the first paragraph beginning on page 6. Anger and hostility. The modern psychologists will steer you wrong here on this case. They will tell you that if you feel anger, best thing that you can do is to express it. Well, the Bible does not teach that. When you read the book of Proverbs, the Bible teaches you the reverse. Well, since the one who inspired the Bible was the same one who made the body, I would expect that if there were any response that the body made, that it would be in accordance with what is written in the Bible. And sure enough, we find that if a person expresses aggression, anger, hostility, there is greater platelet activity inside one's blood vessels. We want plenty of platelet activity if we bleed, if we've been cut, but then we want it in response to thromboplastin, tissue thromboplastin, which is released on injury. We don't want this to occur inside our blood vessels just because of our thoughts, do we? And so, how do you get rid of aggression, anger, and hostility if you don't give that to somebody else? Well, as a friend of mine says, you plug in the knees. Plug in the knees. And then, by plugging in your knees, you then get rid of hostility, aggression, and anger. Because the Lord can bear these. He had a body made for Him to bear our afflictions. He said so. He said, a body has been given to me, was prepared for Him, so that He could bear these. He can, and He will take these. If you're heavy laden, come to Him, and He will give you rest from hostility and anger and aggression. Now, older people who have had a previous stroke, they may or may not be likely to have another stroke if their motion alone is involved in the deficit from their stroke. Rather than their mental faculties, then they are not so likely to have a repeat stroke. If their mental faculties are involved, they are more likely to have a repeat stroke. Now, as we get older, we're also more likely to have a small injury, such as bumping the steering wheel of a car, or bumping the window of a car when somebody makes a sharp turn, or in some way you bump the head. A small injury to the head can result in a major injury to the brain in older people. So a young person could be in a major accident, have no problem. An older person in this, with the same amount of trauma could have much more problems with the brain. So a concussion in an older person should be treated very carefully. I like to give them bed rest for at least one day, if not more. Now, those with migraine headaches are slightly more likely to get a stroke, but only if their type of migraine is associated with what is called an aura. That is, before the headache actually begins, they see certain things or smell certain things or taste certain things. These individuals are the ones that are the more likely to get the stroke. Now, a nice little thing that you can look at in your own blood analyses when you get your laboratory tests back. If you have a white blood cell count, you're more likely to get a thrombosis or a blood clot in your brain. White blood cell count. What is ideal? Well, anything up to about 5.5 on your laboratory report. That means 5,500 white blood cells per cubic millimeter. 5.5 and under is ideal. And so we want to try to have that if we can. Notice there that men with a white blood cell count above 8,100 have a 39% increase in the risk of strokes compared to those having white counts below 6,600. Smoking, the use of alcohol and coffee, all of these increase your risk of getting strokes. Now, the widespread use of aspirin has been advocated as keeping you from getting a heart attack and in some instances keeping you from getting a stroke. But if you have a hemorrhage in your brain and you're taking aspirin or have taken aspirin for your headache, it will make the hemorrhage worse, do you see? And so we don't want to take aspirin. And if I were the FDA, I would make aspirin a prescription item, because a lot of people die every year because of taking aspirin. Then the contraceptive pill. You will see that, page 7, middle of the page. Contraceptive pill increases the likelihood of getting a stroke. And hormone replacement therapy in menopausal women also carries a little increased risk of strokes. I and Dr. Arthur Berry of Columbus, Georgia, reported the very first case of emboli in a woman who was taking a contraceptive pill. That was many, many, many years ago, because the pill has been been around for quite a long time. Now, on page 8, you will see an illustration showing a clot blocking one of the cerebral arteries. And you will see that a little shaded area is out on the side beyond the place where the clot is. And that is the stroke area. Now, another marker that you have is homocysteine. You will see that middle of page 8, just under the illustration. As the homocysteine level in the blood goes up, so does the risk of stroke. Now, if you decide you want one of these tests, take this book with you and show it to your doctor, because while you can get the test in an ordinary laboratory now, it still isn't a common test, and they will give you a homocysteine level, not a homocysteine level. And the homocysteine level is not the marker. But the homocysteine level is easier to do and costs less money than the other one. Now, how to prevent a stroke? You can see those. And a high potassium diet is very helpful. And you will see a listing of foods that are high in potassium beginning on page 10. And then on page 14, you will see magnesium discussed. So potassium and magnesium are minerals that we want to have in good supply. But what about iron? Not so with iron. you will see a little paragraph about iron on page 8, top of the page, about iron supplements. Don't take iron supplements unless they are clearly indicated in your case. Blackstrap molasses may not be indicated for you either. If you have any one of these five diseases in your family, then you want to stay away from sugar as much as you can. Sugar also dehydrates the blood, makes it more thick. That increases your likelihood of getting a thrombosis or a blood clot. Okay, now,
sugar, honey,
syrup, molasses, any of those, they all thicken the blood. And you know how honey is on a cold morning? That's what it does in your bloodstream. It thickens it up. You know, honey is never really free-flowing, not even when it's hot. And we don't get it hot enough to make it free-flowing. And so in the blood, it is not free-flowing. So if you have any other cause, or you're getting past the age of about 60 or 65, then it probably would be well if you start really cutting out the sugar. And if you like sweet things, if your sweet tooth is like mine, way down to here, it's hard for me to close my mouth because of my sweet tooth. Then what can you do? You can eat sweet fruits. In fact, lay in a big supply of them. And what about sucanat? Sucanat is dried cane juice. And I wish I could tell you that it was perfectly scot-free for you, but it isn't. It comes with the same kind of cautions that these other concentrated sweeteners do.
Now,
that new thing. Stevia. Oh, you may use stevia. This is an herb. It is not a concentrated sweetener. Now, I promised you at the beginning of this lecture that I would talk about the treatment of strokes, but now I don't want to talk about that. I want you to read it because somebody has already stood up back in the back and is telling me my time is up. So I'm just going to ask you if you would like to ask some questions. How many of you would like to ask questions? Want to raise your hands right now? I will take three of these. So which three? The others of you, write your questions down. So, all right. Let me get hers. I'll get yours. And one other, I'll get yours. All right, these three. Number one.
Mine is cardiac arrhythmia.
Cardiac arrhythmia. We have a very good counseling sheet on that called atrial fibrillation. And while it is called atrial fibrillation, we discuss all of the usual rhythm disturbances, also with one called PAT, or paroxysmal auricular tachycardia. You can get those at New Lifestyle Books. So just stop by there and ask Andrea for them, and she'll be able to get them for you. Question number two. Yes. Pulse is very good. Systolic blood pressure is quite high, and might be good if you talked with Dr. Calvin Thrash. This is in his specialty, and he will be happy to talk with you about it, and maybe some special things that you might do for your blood pressure. I had a patient one time whose blood pressure, she came to me and said, now, Dr. Thrash, I want to tell you, I'm not going in the hospital. She pointed her finger right in my face. So I said, well, Moselle, let me examine you and let's see what we should do for you. And so she said, all right, well, you can examine me. I want you to know that I'm only here because my son made me come. I've got some good doctors, and they've been taking good care of me, and I don't know why he wanted me to come here. And, well, with that, I felt a little bit not so good, but I started examining her. When I got to her blood pressure, I said, Moselle, you need to go with me to Uchi Pines right now. I've already told you, I'm not going to the hospital. Well, I couldn't convince her this was not a hospital. She said, I'm old. She was 3 years younger than I was. She says, my life is finished, and I'm not going to spend any more money on doctors. I've been taking the best medicines in the world, treated by the best doctors in the world, and there's no need for me to try to do anything more. So I said, well, I'll try to treat you as an outpatient, but I really don't recommend it. I really recommend that you come with me. I want you to know that's my recommendation. So I wrote out 3 pages of instructions for her, gave it to her nurse daughter-in-law who had come with her, and she said, Mother, this nurse was a little crusty herself, and she said, Mother will do this. Well, I didn't know whether she could get her to do that or not, but she took my 3 sheets and they left and went home. So I said, come back in a week and let me see what, but I won't treat you unless you call every day and let me know what her blood pressure is. So she said, okay. So nurse called me the next day and she said, her blood pressure, by the way, was 240 over 140. That's why I became so upset about it. And nurse called me the next day and she says, her blood pressure's down a little bit. It's 130. But I had already looked through her papers and not one blood pressure for the past year had been under 240 over 140. Not one. She had all of her papers with her and not a single good blood pressure or even better than 240 over 140. So nurse said it was a little better. Next day, nurse said it was a little better. Next day, nurse said it was a little better. And I just wondered whether her nurse daughter-in-law was just doing some wishful thinking. When she came in and I took her blood pressure again in a week, her blood pressure was 198 over 110. So I said, well, Moselle, you've done a good job this week. She said, nobody ever told me how to get my blood pressure down. Now, she sang that song to me 5 times with the same inflection exactly. Nobody ever told me how to get my blood pressure down. So at the end of something like 5 weeks, she had lost about 20 pounds and her blood pressure was down to 118, I think it was, over 75. From time to time, I see her son, who is an Adventist minister, and I say, how is Moselle doing? He says, fine. What's her blood pressure like? Oh, 110 over 80, just where it's been the last X number of years. She's really faithful with that. We'll get your question really quickly. Okay. Sugar, you may have the sugar in fruit. As it comes in the fruit, not the fructose. Just eat the fruit. Dry fruit, you may have that too. Recognize that you need to eat a little bit smaller quantity of the dry fruit.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony. Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.